Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files podcast, the podcast that's speaking a little quieter than normal today because Melanie didn't bring her headphones. I'm one of your hosts, John Bruford, joined by your... Oh man, I'm going to have to look up the title for this. Just bear with me one moment. I did use it on the last episode. There, here it is. Joined by my guest interim intro stand-in temporary co-host, Melanie Ellis, partner at Northridge Law. Melanie, hello.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me. And in my defence, I would just say I don't have my headphones because I was only asked to do this when I was already on my way into the office. So
excuse after excuse with you.
So any complaints about sound quality should be directed to John, please.
Would you? Is this how you talk to a client?
Pretty much. No, I'm a lot nicer to them.
I feel honoured. But it's lovely to have you back, Mel, obviously. Have you been making any pastries of late?
I'm not making any pastries right now because I'm trying to be a bit more healthy in my eating choices at the moment.
What does healthy look like?
Basically not eating pastries.
But that's not...
Last night I cooked a pizza and I ate half of it and had a salad with it. So that those are healthy choices.
I've got strange ideas about food. And when I ignore those strange ideas about food, I got fat again. So that's good. I showed Fintan a photo yesterday. I'm like, Fintan, this is what I looked like 3 years ago. There were angles in my face. And Fintan's like, yeah, I remember Skinny John. So do I. I remember the clothes that he had and everything.
Was it worth it though? You were just eating meat, weren't you?
Yeah. And meat is happy food for me. People focus on the meat part of it, but it's high fat, zero carb. Because carbs absolutely wreck me. And that's just something that's right for me. And it was great, and I thrived on it. But earlier this year, I discovered some feelings that needed eating. And I ate them all, and some more. And I put 3 stone on. Listeners in the US, that would be 42 pounds, thereabouts, in 3 months.
Some big feelings. Did you eat them in extra meat and fat, or did you revert to the carbs?
No, you see, the trick is if you want to gain that much weight, you've got to act as though you're still eating high fat, zero carb, and introduce carbs. So, for example, you might get up in the morning and think, right, today I am not going to do that shit anymore. Have some beef for your breakfast, for example. Think, great, this is going really well. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you've buggered off to the supermarket and bought 2 packs of donuts. And it's that combination that really piles it on. I mean, 3 stone in 3 months is a lot and fast. Given that it took me, 4 years to get to where I was.
4 years to lose 40 pounds in the 3 months.
So, yeah. Good times.
Well, I think, our bodies are set up to try and stack on weight just in case there's a famine, as there were lots of in our evolutionary past. So
for winter as well, we pile on weight for winter, as most mammals do.
Yeah, so that we can keep warm when we don't turn the heating on.
So that we can fundamentally hibernate.
Yeah.
Or do so as little as possible and stay alive.
Yeah, we're like to lose weight, you're just fighting against nature, aren't you? So that's why it's difficult.
You say that, but am I fighting nature or am I agreeing with nature?
Well, now, yeah, you've agreed to accept the extra weight.
Well, no, now I am back on the high-fat, zero-carb, but it's, people always say, oh, but is it healthy eating like that? Well, if you think about this in evolutionary terms, there is nowhere on the planet that has a source of fruit, vegetables all year round. There is no such plant. And all of those plants that we do eat, they tend to come into being pretty good just before the weather gets really cold, that point at which we start piling on weight to survive winter. That's not really a coincidence, I don't think.
Yeah, I think you're probably right that we would have gained weight for winter, and then, but you know, I guess there was probably preserving techniques and so on, so people were, I would imagine, still eating. I don't know. But yeah.
There's a terrific book, I think it's called Before and After. Can't remember, it's by a dude called Andrew Shanahan. I've got a feeling it was self-published, but it was unusually good. And it's like a zombie apocalypse type book.
Okay.
But it's about this enormously fat dude who's so fat that he's got to be lifted out of his house. They take the side wall out of it because he lives in a flat and he hasn't been out for years. They take the wall out so that he can go into a hospital for an operation. And while he's being crane lifted down, the zombie apocalypse happens.
Wow, what are the chances?
And he's in midair with this crowd of verbally abusive zombies below him. But it turns out he's perfectly equipped for the zombie apocalypse because he's got so much fat to burn. He doesn't, as long as he's got water, he's fine.
Okay, but how did he run away from the zombies?
He didn't have to. He's hanging in the air.
Ah, they couldn't get to him. Right. So he just sat there.
Well, no, there's more to it than that. It is a very fun book. It's a good read. Mel, last episode we had Scott Longley as the guest interim intro stand-in temporary co-host.
Of, he wasn't available today?
Earnings and more. No, he's available, but I like variety in my partners. God, that sounds so bad. And anybody that knows me will probably say that that's not true. I'm very much a one-woman man, Mel.
No.
just in case my new lady's listening to this. But I was talking to Scott about all sorts to do with the UK. But the UK is in a funny place at the moment, isn't it? It's like a post-apocalyptic zombie-riddled wasteland.
Well, I think we're just sort of waiting to see if the zombie apocalypse will happen, I think, in November's budget, I would say.
It's a strange time to be in the industry. It's all of this, like if I were at the Gambling Commission, I'd be getting a hair transplant just so that I could pull my hair out. Because, as I said to Scott, I can't see them saying to the government, yeah, that's a brilliant idea. Whack taxes, right? That's bound to work. It's not like there's any evidence that it goes badly wrong anywhere else in Europe, anywhere recently.
Yeah, that's a really difficult one, because if you're in the industry, associated with the industry, and you say, don't put taxes up on gambling, people say, well, yeah, of course you'd say that. So it's difficult to actually make the case for why it's a bad idea without it just sounding like, well, yeah, you don't want taxes to go up.
Well, the thing is, the industry can absorb a tax hike. There's no two ways about that. But the point at which they're saying it could happen to is absolutely mental.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that all operators can absorb a tax hike.
I'm talking about the industry as a whole.
Yeah.
If we're talking a couple of percent, people will be like, oh shit, well, this is the new normal. Let's crack on with it and figure out how this works.
I do think even if it's not too bad and the industry as a whole can absorb it, I do think there's a lot of probably smaller operators who already, things are very tight for them, that they may just say, well, it doesn't make sense anymore. And then that's just, I mean, yeah, maybe in the grand scheme of things, that's not terrible overall, but it's taking away consumer choice, just leaving them with the larger operators.
It is, but there's an awful lot of things that could happen that could influence that. A rise in national insurance, employer contributions, rent rises, rates rises, etc.
It's not as simple as.
But I mean, I've figured out a way that, and this is controversial, so you might want to distance yourself from this now.
Okay, this has nothing to do with me.
I've figured out a way that UK operators can mitigate a tax rise, some of it.
Okay. Okay. Go offshore?
No, that's plan B.
Okay.
Plan A is stop paying your dues to the Betting and Gaming Council.
Interesting.
Because, frankly, it looks to me at the moment, with the way that things are going, to be money flushed down the toilet. But yeah, what do I know?
Not my suggestion.
I'm not even on their mailing list. I'm not bitter about it. But I did ask the top lady to come on the podcast, and she said, sure. And talk to my people, sort out a time. So I sent the necessary emails. And after months, and I mean months, of just gently prodding, can we come back to this? Can we pick this up again? Came back, oh, this isn't the right thing for us at this time. I'm like, this is after the lady has been on multiple other podcasts. All right, can you maybe tell me why that would be? It's just not the right thing at this time. Okay. Well, we can plan something in for the future when it might be the right time. Can you think when that might be? No.
I think she doesn't like your co-hosts, obviously.
And then I was de-linked from her on LinkedIn.
Oh, dear.
So,
So you've done something to offend her?
Well, I've been highly critical of the BGC, but...
Well, maybe that's...
You know, not all journalists are kiss asses and sycophants. Some of them actually ask questions and think it's not unreasonable for a body that represents the industry to maybe answer those questions. Because I'm not the only person thinking of them. I'm just the only one that's saying them out loud. But yeah, like I say, what do I know? They probably got de-linked by accident. They probably just forgot about the podcast invitation. Yeah, that's probably it. Yeah. Why attribute malice to anything when it could just be shitty practices?
Yes. Yes. Or...
I know, that's not the phrase, is it? But you get where I'm coming from with that. But I'm not bitter, Mel. And I'm not interested in burning bridges because life's too short.
Indeed. Maybe if you did a few episodes where you did some positive comments about the work BGC are doing, maybe you could.
Yeah, do you know what? Where they're at now, apart from what's been happening with the racing industry, which should never have been done in public ever in a million years, apart from that, the BGC is a massive improvement over where it was. Massive improvement. I do still say that it can't work as a body because there are too many conflicting interests. And just because everybody is involved in betting stroke gambling, that doesn't mean they have the same interests. That's just common sense. You know, the enemy of my enemy is not necessarily my friend.
I do think there is a lot of commonality, though. There's a lot of shared interests amongst those who are operating legitimately in the UK under a license from the Gambling Commission. I probably disagree and say there is a role for a sort of a industry-wide body like the BGC.
There is commonality, definitely. Of course there is. But I think that it ignores the areas of conflict. The existence of a soul body ignores the areas of conflict, and that each part of the industry should still have its own lobbying body, should have its own fighters, so to speak, because, you know, well, you know what I'm saying. I think I stand by it. I haven't got any hair. I don't know everything, but yeah, as what's been happening with the racing industry shows, you know, there are areas where there is a massive gap and relatively little commonality. But then, in fact, as I discussed with Scott in the last episode, if the tax hikes happen to the extent that they're talked about, the racing industry is going to be the one that disappears, not any of the others.
Yeah, I mean, with the taxes, I think there's been so much speculation that we really just need to wait and see.
Oh, some certainty. What happens.
But yeah, I think there'll be some sort of increase, but whether it affects, I mean,
Do you think they're doing a Trumpian thing here and saying, yeah, we're going to bring these taxes in that are going to basically obliterate the industry, and then are going to bring them in slightly lower and say, see how nice we are?
Yeah, well, definitely there's that. So that everyone's going to be relieved when they're not the sort of 50% that's been thrown about or anywhere near that. But, yeah, I do think any increase is going to affect what's going to affect some operators, and it's going to obviously affect the black market issue that we have. I think just even a tiny difference is going to mean operators have to slightly reduce the bonuses, slightly shift their odds, and we're already at a bit of a tipping point with people, you know, choosing to gamble elsewhere. And yeah, that's my worry, and it's difficult to get that point across being part of the industry, that it is the most vulnerable people who will be actually hurt by tax increase, ironically, because they're the ones that once they find their way onto black market sites are going to be in real danger, sort of, you know, unchecked gambling, no interactions. So yeah, genuinely concerned about it.
There's also potentially a further knock on socially with this, which is that, and again, this is something I did talk about with Scott, that, okay, if I'm an operator and I've got a retail setup, the retail setup is going to be the more complicated to manage. It's got the most moving parts and probably brings in the least amount of profit in relative terms. So that's the one that's going to get hit. Now, as has been noted many times by our friends at The Guardian, an awful lot of bookies are in poorer areas, not just because the rents are lower, although that is definitely a factor, not just because the rents are lower, but because a lot of their customers are in those areas. Because, you know, with deprivation comes desperation and the need for hope, and that can come in the form of a bet. Little reasons like that. But people that don't necessarily understand poverty, having never lived it, are not going to be writing that in their newspaper. But if the retail sector is the one that takes the brunt of this, and it almost certainly would be, then those deprived areas also lose a part of the community, because a betting shop is in fact part of the community, especially for older single men living alone. But also, very significantly, they lose jobs in that area, in an area that almost certainly doesn't have many anyway. So the levels and different areas in which the industry gets dicked, it's actually much broader than it seems. And the people that are at risk, if you read those Guardian reports, those people in those poor areas, etc., have even less after this. Potentially. But like you say, it's all extrapolation at the moment, and it's what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, yeah, we can talk about it once we know, once the budget's happened.
Well, do you want to come on when the budget happens?
Yeah, we could do, maybe we could do like a live stream or something.
Ooh, now you're talking.
Discuss everything.
Just imagine what I could get away with saying it live.
Whoa. Exciting prospect.
That's a great idea. Sponsored by Northridge Law.
But yeah, let's see what happens. And yeah, probably it's not going to be as bad as people are thinking, but it probably will still be bad.
But. Well, definitely the one thing we can say with some certainty is that change is coming. It'd be nice for things to just stay steady for a bit. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Let's just leave things
there. Yeah, I know. But that's what makes us an interesting industry to work in, isn't it? That it's always changing. Regulations are changing, but also, you know, new products, new ways of doing things. That's what makes it fun, isn't it? So.
Yeah, I guess. Maybe I'm just tired. Maybe I've just been sleeping badly. Anyway, so Mel, something I did want to talk to you about Did you know that every matrix is delivering advanced turnkey platform technology to the global regulated iGaming and lottery industries with outstanding results?
Are they?
Yeah.
Excellent.
They're also, in no particular order, powering the world's biggest brands, solving your biggest challenges, and taking your business to the next level. Do you know why, Mel?
No, I don't. I can't really tell me.
Because with every matrix, everything is possible.
Good to know.
Mm. Also, something that I was certainly thinking about in the night when I woke up, I was thinking about Optimove. Yeah, they're the creators of the positionless marketing concept. And it's the number one player engagement platform in the iGaming industry, used by, I think it's over 50% of the EGR Power 50.
Learn something new every time I come on this.
Well, me and Fintan, we had the demo from them, right? And it was awesome. I mean, it was like mind-blowingly awesome. And so what we've been saying to people, well, you know, if they ask, and in recordings, we say, get the demo. If you're up for some CRM, if you're looking to grow your business, work on your customer retention, get the demo. You'll be amazed. And if you tell them you came from the Gambling Files, you get a month free. I mean, it's a steal. Do you know what I'm saying?
Excellent. You know, as you were talking just then, I was thinking about how your new quiet delivery, it's quite ASMR. I think you could reach a whole new audience.
What if I knit while I'm talking?
Yeah, perfect. Perhaps pour yourself a drink with some ice.
That could also work.
Yes. Send your ASMR Gambling Files.
I think this is why the kids like me reading to them at night. Like, you'd think they'd be too old for it, like 13, 10 and 8, but they all demand story before bed. Like the 10-year-old, he's always asleep before the end of the first chapter.
That was me when I was a kid. My dad read me Lord of the Rings, and I just have sort of memories of just small sections of it. And then when I read it as an adult, I was like, oh, I don't remember any of this stuff happening.
I hear you. I had a similar experience, which was Star Wars. So Star Wars was the first film I ever saw at the cinema. And I was 3. Now, Star Wars, when it came on the TV, it would have been about 1980, I think. And it was the first movie where they'd paid £1 million for the TV rights. So this was like, this is this big deal. And it's fucking Star Wars, dude. And I remember sitting there watching it with my mum. And I got towards the end and I just turned to mum and said, I don't remember any of this stuff. She's like, yeah, you fell asleep.
Yeah, I mean, 3-year-old in a movie, that's quite a big ask, isn't it?
Yeah, and such an intense movie visually as
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
So I was, yeah. But amazing how much I did remember. It did leave quite an impression. Of course, later I went to see The Empire Strikes Back with my brother. That would have been 81, when I would have been 7. And my parents... Yeah, one of the nice things they did was if there was a really big movie, my mum would basically say, right, you can have the afternoon off school. Nice. Both of you, me and my brother. My brother would have to take me to the cinema to see it. And we bunked off school and went to see The Empire Strikes Back. And it was one of those ones where your parents say to you, right, just say I had an upset stomach and I had to go home, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, oh, right, upset stomach, had to go home, upset stomach, had to go home. Mr. Bruford, where were you yesterday? I went to see The Empire Strikes Back and it was awesome.
Oops.
Oh.
I guess parents didn't get fined in those days.
I had one job. So yeah, good times, good times. So listen, this episode, right, you weren't here for the interview.
Awesome.
And nor was Fintan. I did a few episodes. I recorded a few episodes back to back recently. And Fintan was doing Fintan things.
Sunning himself somewhere again?
Sunning himself while probably having a very busy executive style meeting.
Okay.
Possibly involving a fat cigar. Yeah, but interestingly enough, the guest that we had was probably more relevant to me than Fintan anyway, because we had on, who did we have on? Oh yeah, I got it.
Tommy.
We had Hugh Thomas on. Mm-hmm. Hugh Thomas from Recovery in Gaming. Now, Hugh has a very interesting story, but it's talking about addiction and recovery and... you know, Hugh talks quite candidly about his own journey, which is pretty fucking hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we get into, you know, we talk about addiction and stuff because I've got some of those myself. So that was pretty interesting for me. I mean, Hugh's done all the other podcasts, I think, before ours. But I really wanted him on because it means a lot to me personally.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really interesting, and it is fascinating. speaking addict to addict,
were there some commonalities that you shared in your experiences, or
what are you saying, that we should form some kind of all party group for all types of addicts? Because
all types of addicts. Mm.
It doesn't work, does it? No. But no, it was yeah, really, really interesting.
Yeah.
But the project is a really, I mean, it's a great idea. I love it. So it's all about recognizing that in an industry this size, there are people who have some addiction troubles, and making sure that if there's an expo or whatever, that there are people around that they can reach out to,
mm-hmm.
and they can just say, I'm struggling a bit. Have you got a minute?
So his organization, they have a presence at various shows.
Yeah, they've done. They did SBC. They did. What's the London affiliate one? That Clarion, our other sponsor, does. Clarion Gaming, the wonderful other sponsors. Oh crap! The affiliate one in London that's gone clean out of my head.
Yeah, no, me too. Sorry, I love you.
But they've had a presence at several shows, including G2E, and they're going to be at ICE in Barcelona. And at the moment, they're looking for funding sources so that they can keep having those presences.
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? Because even just a small stand in an out of the way place is quite a lot of money, and ideally, you'd want to be somewhere more visible. You'd think.
I think part of the issue isn't necessarily having a booth or whatever, because one of the things about addiction is that a lot of people feel some shame attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily about having somewhere where people can actually go in person to visit. Okay. It's about that sort of group presence, that knowing that there is a network out there and being able to develop that. And yes, being seen is a thing, obviously. Mm. And you never know, somebody might come on there and say, I didn't realize this, but I'm really struggling.
Or just sort of, at least it's somewhere for them to get some information. And then if later they decide they do want to get in touch, then
yeah,
they know someone to contact.
So, yeah, it's a many-layered thing, but they're looking for some funding to keep the project going and develop it. And yeah, if anybody's out there listening and they have some money, give it some thought, because given the way that the industry works and the way that we all live and behave within it, then there are definitely addicts out there, and I've definitely been drugged with some of them. And at some point we're all going to need some support. But anyway, so this episode is with Hugh Thomas. He's a very nice man, so meet Hugh. We're joined by this week's guest on the podcast. Now, I'm not an excitable person as such, but I am very pleased to welcome him, because we're talking about something that's very close to my heart. No Fintan, because I'm recording this in a little period where he's poorly. So, Fintan, I hope you're feeling a bit better if you're listening to this. But if you're still poorly, that means that you've been off for a couple of weeks now. So pull your fucking finger out, dude. I'd like to welcome our guest, Mr. Hugh Thomas, co-founder of Recovery in Gaming. Now, Hugh, you've done everybody else's podcast, so it's about time you came on this one.
There we go. I'm here. I'm ready. Thank you for having me.
Recovery in Gaming, what is it?
So, what is it? It is a recovery community for people who are struggling with drugs or alcohol addiction. So it's pretty new, John, to be honest, and we're still kind of finding our feet a little bit. That's what it's there to do. And
within the gambling industry.
Within the gambling industry, yeah. And you know, lots of people have asked me, including you, I think, when we sort of chatted a few weeks ago, you know, does it cover gambling addiction too? And the answer to that is it doesn't, because I'm not a gambling addict myself. And so it's strictly drugs and alcohol. And, you know, we've been turning up to lots of industry events and sort of throwing open the doors and meeting people and people in recovery, people who are interested in learning more. So that's what we're doing, and we've had a really overwhelming sort of response. You know, I think, I mean, I've literally spoken to hundreds, you know, multiple hundreds probably of people over the last couple of months. And it's funny that not one person has said, we don't need recovery in our industry. So,
yeah, I was talking to a chap many years ago. Let's call him Rob, because that is his name. I was talking to Rob, and he said, I love this industry. It's just like being a rock star without groupies.
I like it. That rings a bell.
And he's like, he's not wrong, because, you know, we get to travel around the world. Yeah. We go to all these cool places. We stay in amazing hotels.
Well, that's it, you know.
Fun times are available, shall we say.
Fun times are available. And I think also, you know, this industry attracts people who I think like to live on the edge a little bit, you know. And, you know, certainly if I think back to, I mean, I joined the industry in the early 2000s. So it was sort of a bit like the Wild West back then, you know, and not much regulation and all that sort of stuff. But you know, some of the characters that we come across in this industry, you know, they wouldn't be out of place in the music industry, or they wouldn't be out of place in the film industry and stuff. So you know, I think also, you know, the pace of innovation that we have in the industry too, it needs a certain type of person who's willing to, you know, think very laterally and all the rest of it. So I think we are, unfortunately, you know, the downside to that is that we are an industry where I suspect we have a slightly higher prevalence of, you know, drug and alcohol addiction. That would be my guess.
Interesting. I used to work in a pub in London about 25 years ago, give or take. Yeah, 26, 27 years ago, actually, thinking about it. And it was right by the offices of EMI.
Oh, yeah.
And AOL.
Wow. Remember that old dial-up?
And on a Friday night, they would all just descend on this one pub.
And off it would go.
They'd be like 10 deep at the bar all night.
Yeah, I can well imagine.
And you know, you finish your shift and you're like, I'm just going to perk myself up a bit. I'm just going to go and lick the top of the cisterns in the toilet. And, of course, from that I learned that our cleaners didn't do a very good job. No, I'm just kidding about licking the cisterns. But I know what you mean about the types of people. Not that's a limited exposure to music industry people, but I've worked consumer press in many different industries, including movies, etc. And yeah, you do see that certain types of people are attracted to certain types of work.
Yeah, that's it. And you know, it's also quite a. I mean, I certainly found the industry. It's quite a late night sport culture as well. You know, you're often out late at night for one reason and another,
and often up early the next day.
Up early the next day, exactly, John. Up and at it.
Which is, it's always screwed me in this industry. But I've also, mind you, when I was drinking, right, and I was very good at it, you know, nobody could say that I wasn't committed. But when I was drinking, I was always a very solitary drinker, not particularly sociable.
Behind closed doors?
Well, no, not necessarily. Like, I might be in a bar, but I'd be in there with a book.
Oh, okay.
Because I'd still want that time to myself, like be amongst people, but not with them.
Okay. Yeah. No, I've seen people in pubs drinking with a book. I don't know what I thought when that. You know, maybe they're waiting for someone or something. But it's interesting that you, interesting that you chose to do that. But I can imagine it's quite relaxing. I mean, to be honest, whenever I had a drink in front of me, I was just necking it and trying to get the next one in. So there was no space for reading or relaxing. I was frantically trying to drink as much as possible.
Yeah, I did. At one time, I was in a casino in Reading, I think. Yeah, Reading. Jimmy was there.
Mecca.
I can't remember which one it was. I think there were three at the time, or two or three at the time. And and my friend Jimmy was managing it. And I went in to see him, and I was just, you know, busy. I was just sitting reading a book, because I've always got a book in my pocket. And I look up, and there's a woman sitting across from me, reading a book.
What?
And I'm like, holy shit, this never happens. And she's like, no, it doesn't ever happen. And I'm like, that's so weird. Anyway, long story short, we ended up having a snog.
Wow, look at that.
This is the strangest thing.
Two little bookworms having a snog.
I know, right? What could be less erotic?
Oh, I wasn't going to say that, but yeah, that's it.
So, You said earlier that it doesn't cover gambling addiction, because I'm not addicted to gambling. I want to delve into that selfish attitude of yours.
Of course.
How did you like? What was your? Let's begin not at the beginning. Let's begin today. So you're sober.
Sober, clean and sober. So yeah,
clean and sober. So clean and sober, for those, that is generally a term used by people who are addicted to alcohol and drugs.
Mm.
So how long are you clean and sober?
So I'm 11 years clean and sober, and I will be 12 years clean and sober in June next year, or July next year, actually. You know, initially it was drugs, and then used alcohol to get off the drugs, and then became addicted to alcohol. And it was kind of a little bit of a journey like that, going from one to the other, to try and desperately get off, you know, both of them, until such point as my life kind of collapsed after many, many years of going round and round in circles. And so that's where I'm at. And I think the interesting thing, or one of the interesting things, is, you know, how I sort of managed to reach that rock bottom and then, you know, dig out of there. And, that's exactly why we set up Recovery and Gaming, because it was very, very hard to find any sort of support 12 years ago. And it took a sort of intervention, if you like, with my employer at Betson, and a very kind intervention to say, you know, Hugh, you need to go and get some help from somewhere, rather than a disciplinary, you know what I mean? And then it was like, shit, what do I do now? Where do I go? Who do I see? And, you know, then I think still that stigma and you know, the very sort of topic of addiction is, you know, it's sort of tucked away a little bit. I mean, a little bit less so in the last few years. But it is still, you know, recovery is still quite hard to access, I think. And that's exactly why we want to do what we're doing with recovery and gaming, is just lift it up so that, you know, anyone that gets themselves into trouble or can't find a way out, at least they know there's a couple of people who they can talk to. And we definitely are not saying, you know, we have some sort of magic fix for everyone, but we do have, you know, an open door and open minds and open hearts to some extent. And that's just what you need to get started, right?
The lived experience voices in any type of addiction, the ones that are able to say to you,
I hear you.
You're not broken.
Yeah.
It's possible to get from where you are to where I am and yeah. beyond.
Yeah.
Because I'm living it right in front of you.
Yeah, exactly that.
And I understand your experience and I'm here to,
yeah.
you know.
And that's why, you know, that's why, to go back to your point about the gambling addiction, that's why we can't do gambling right now, is because I wouldn't know what to say to a gambling addict. You know, I haven't been there. I haven't, you know, bet the house. I haven't, you know, and it's very difficult. You know, I'll give you another example, right? So when I've been through the journey of recovery in the last sort of 12 years, you know, I've had many friends of mine who've got kids who are, you know, wrapped up in the wrong stuff and getting addicted to all sorts. And, you know, the parents call me up and they say, you know, oh, you know, what do you have a little word with Johnny and see if you can help him out. And initially I was like, okay, cool. I'll call Johnny and I'll, you know, have a chat to him. And of course, you know, the reception I get from Johnny is, you know, piss off. I don't, you know, my parents are just a pain in the ass and I don't want to talk to anyone. And then I couldn't work out like why I was getting this sort of reception. And I spoke to someone else in recovery and I said, you know, God, I'm trying to help all these people out. And he just turned around to me and he said, did they ask for your help? I was like, well, no, but his parents did. I was like, well, you know, until such time as Johnny asked for help, stay the hell away. You know what I mean? And,
but that's not human nature, is it?
It's not.
Human nature is to help people that need fucking help.
Yeah. And it's certainly not what parents want to hear. But unfortunately, you know, I have sat in the rooms of, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous too. And I've seen the people that get dragged in by, you know, wives or husbands or parents into the meetings.
This, I don't need this. This isn't for me.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I don't want to be here. I don't want to listen. This is not for me. These people are not like me. You know, I don't want to be here. And unfortunately, it often takes a, you know, calamity of some sort to get people through the doors of recovery. So, you know, you need to lose your marriage, lose your house, lose your job, whatever it is. And then you kind of wake up and think, oh, hang on a minute, something's going numb. Something is going wrong here. But until that happens, you know, it's life just continues.
Yeah, it does seem to, doesn't it?
Yeah. Have you had any contact with addiction in your nearest and dearest or friends or?
Yeah, I've got lots of sober friends, an awful lot, actually. Some of them, they've just recognized that things were going a bit shit. It wasn't necessarily an addiction or whatever, but they just recognized that it wasn't, their life wasn't going in a good direction, and so they sobered and stayed good sober. I have a few friends who are, yeah, they did, but completely diverse as well. So Lady Sarah that I know, I bumped into Sarah at a petrol station a couple of months ago. And like I always describe myself as sober, despite never having been diagnosed with alcoholism, because I recognized that the relationship was just totally fucking abusive, right. You know.
Good for you.
But for me as well, it's wrapped up with a few other things.
Mm.
So it's not as simple as alcohol. It's like sugar and fucking all kinds of other stupid shit. But anyway.
I know, but no, it's an important topic, that one, though, that you mentioned. You know, it's like you know, if you listen to some of the experts in addiction, I'll tell you one is Gabor Mate. You know, he talks a lot about, you know, drugs and alcohol being the solution, and food and exercise and whatever it is that people are addicted to. It's like, you know, they're the solution to a feeling, general feeling of unease and discomfort and whatever. And everyone tries to then treat the, you know, the alcoholism or the, you know, the drug addiction itself. And it's like, well, actually it's much, much deeper than that. You know what I mean? And I think, you know, this is part of the kind of education piece that I think needs to happen around addiction is, you know, it's often seen as a sort of self-inflicted, you know, wound of some sort. You know, when in actual fact it's some sort of coping mechanism or some sort of pain relief that people are trying to get. And, you know, I still do it now with food sometimes. You know, if I'm feeling particularly anxious or, you know, extremely tired or stressed, you know, I reach for not just one chocolate bar, but, you know, three or four chocolate bars.
Yeah, food is a big one for me now.
Yeah, yeah.
It was part of what's made me the man I am today. The fat fucker you see before you. but it's not. So I bumped into Sarah at the petrol station and I said to her, because I very rarely see her, I said, oh, she said, how are you doing? I said, funny, I should bump into you. I'm 7 years sober. And she was like, holy shit. But she reminded me that 10 or 12 years before that, I had been asking her about AA meetings and sobriety.
Mm.
So it was bubbling under in there. It was.
Yeah.
And luckily she was just completely frank about it and completely frank about her experience, as only alcoholics in recovery can be.
Right.
You know, I was this fucking bad.
Yeah.
And she didn't just fucking hit rock bottom. She went plunging through it. Into the cold pool underneath, I think.
Wow.
But she's married to a chap who's also sober. She's repaired a relationship with her daughter. Mm. She looks fantastic. She looks so fantastic. Like, nobody would look at her and think she's like 51. Not a chance. She's beautiful, happy. And she recognizes that if she hadn't made that change, she would not be any of those things right now.
Nice.
And my friend Toby, who's also been on this podcast as a special guest star, and Toby's a comedian. And of course, an awful lot of people in that kind of profession do wind up with issues because something you touched on, late nights.
Yeah.
Late nights in bars.
Yeah, I can believe it. You know, I can believe it. And I think, you know, when you talk about Sarah there and, you know, one of the most amazing things about recovery and stopping doing all of those extremely harmful things is how quickly the body recovers, you know. And I didn't have sort of, you know, liver counts and all of that stuff. I just came straight in and just, you know, started to get well and didn't bother with any of that. But, you know, I've known people in recovery who've, you know, come into the rooms, they've been yellow, you know, liver's packing up.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's about, for some of them, it's about 6 months to a year before their liver is fully recovered.
That's amazing.
You know, lots of people think that, you know, getting well and you know, takes a long, long time, and it really doesn't, in my experience.
No, the process, it's not dissimilar to quitting smoking.
Yeah.
You know, the actual, your body starts sorting its shit out within a few days.
Yeah.
Those first few days are hideous, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But your body does start sorting itself out.
Yeah.
And everything starts working again. Yeah. One of the big reasons why I quit when I did, apart from being fucking morbidly obese, pre-diabetic, etc. I mean, I was like, I'm 5'6" and I was about 19 stone.
Okay.
Which I'm just going to have to do a bit of a calculation here for our American listeners. that would be 14 times 19 equals 266 pounds, give or take. which is pretty heavy for somebody my height.
Yeah.
And I was active. I was running a fair amount, would you believe? I was using the gym. I was drinking a lot. You got to drink a lot to maintain that kind of weight.
I bet.
And then I ended up with gout.
Ouch. Never had gout, but I've heard it's very painful.
I would, if I were reviewing it on TripAdvisor now, I would put gout would not recommend.
Would not recommend. One star.
One star. I would give it less if I could. Yeah, it's a really unique pain.
Yeah.
It's like I've had shingles and stuff like that, and I once had somebody close a car boot on my shoulder.
Sounds painful.
No, it got worse because they still didn't realize it was my shoulder that was in it, and that was why they couldn't close it. And then they jumped on it the second time.
Slam it down again.
Yeah.
Stopping it.
And shit like that, but gout, far and away. Yeah,
what is the sort of like medical definition of that? Like what is happening when you get gout? Is it some sort of blood?
It's genetics are a big part of it generally. Mm. But it's the blood's inability or your kidney's inability to deal with uric acid.
Okay.
Right. Which leads to a buildup of crystals. And almost everybody gets the first attack in the same place. Which is the big toe of the right foot.
Wow.
It's a bottleneck.
Amazing.
And from there, you can get it in any joint in the body, and it can become absolutely hideous. Wow. But talking to the doctor's like, you know, you could quit drinking. And I'm like, quit drinking or have this develop? Because, like, I knew what it was because of where it was. So I looked it up and I looked up, you know, worst case scenarios and people having these toffee squeezed out of their knuckles and all kinds of fucking horrible shit. And I thought, this is a choice.
This is a choice.
But it turns out, so there are loads of triggers, different people, different triggers or different combinations. And the big trigger for me was sugar, which I was getting in. I never had a sweet tooth. I was getting it in beer.
Okay.
Quit drinking. Discovered chocolate, having never had a sweet tooth. Managed to stay very fat. But that's how I realized that sugar was a in tandem.
Yeah.
With really liking being drunk.
It's interesting, and it sounds horrific, gout, and. But, you know, like you say, with a small number of alterations to lifestyle and relatively easy to shift by the sounds of it.
Yeah, well, I've come off the medication for it as well, which is very unusual. But it means that I have my liver and kidney function checked every year.
Oh, you do? Yeah.
So because it can have liver,
That must be fine now, right?
The doctor's very words when he gave me the results a few weeks ago were, if you're thinking about buying health insurance or life insurance, now would be a great time to do it because they'll be delighted with these results.
There you go. Perfect timing.
It's crazy. But the body has a staggering ability to recover.
Doesn't it?
But you've got to give it a chance.
You've got to give it, exactly. You've got to give it a bit of a rest, haven't you? And yeah, I totally get it. But, you know, it is one of the joys, isn't it? I mean, of, you know, sitting in recovery meetings, watching people sort of fall through the doors on day one and then watching them over 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. I mean, you see them on social media sometimes. It's all like before and after meth.
Fucking hell. As soon as you said before and after, I had crystal meth in my head.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you see them, don't you? You see them. This is, you know, here's the mugshot of when Sally was arrested in, you know, LA, and, you know, here's Sally 10 years sober, and it's phenomenal.
Yeah, they don't even look as though they're related.
No, that's it.
But it's not just a British thing. Sometimes it's really, really difficult for people to learn that they can have unconditional support and to accept that support.
Yeah.
Even to accept that they need that support, but they might recognize they need it and not feel they deserve it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, that's
so
it.
How does recovery in gaming work? I mean, I see you've got a nice hoodie and I totally approve of your merch game. It's very strong. But how is this going to work going forward? Is this going to be something where, like, I don't know, fucking ICE in January, which is organized by Clarion Gaming, sponsors of this fabulous podcast.
Lovely.
Is there going to be like a space for recovery in gaming? Is it going to be like a WhatsApp group and people be available to, look, I'm really struggling. Can somebody, is anybody, blah? Do you know what I mean?
How's that going to work? On all of the above. Yeah, you know what? And you mentioned Clarion there, and I will say that I met the Clarion team in Vegas last week, actually, and I had a chat with Robin on his little podcast. And I think Clarion, I've got a meeting with them tomorrow, actually, to chat through Barcelona. And I think we'll find that we will have a space like we've had at, in G2E and like we've had at Lisbon as well. And, you know, what we're finding is a couple of things. One is we get a nice little flow of people come and meet us when we've got our little rooms. But I think there is a challenge that we've got, which is people come into our rooms at these events and they sort of put their head through the door and they sort of do a quick scan of the room to make sure they don't know anyone that's in there, which is completely understandable. I mean, you don't want to walk into a room like Recovery and Gaming and you find that your boss is there or your, you know, your colleague is there or whatever it is. And so we're in this strange kind of middle ground where we're, you know, we want to be there for people, but we're not entirely sure whether we're in the right place. Like maybe outside of events, you know, like a bit further down the road, or maybe we're in a room in a hotel down the road, so it can be a lot more discreet. But, you know, the general idea is that we, you know, we're visible, you know, at these events. We do these podcasts, you know, we've done a ton of them now. And we're trying to work out to strike that sort of balance between being there, but also being discreet and anonymous and all the rest of it. And it's very hard. But yeah, we certainly met. You know, when I was in Vegas, there was a guy turned up to our recovery and gaming room from one of the tribal communities. And he sort of walked in and sat down and I could see he was like really upset. And he said, I want you to know that I'm not a drug addict or an alcoholic. And I said, you know, that's okay.
That's okay. I am.
Yeah, exactly. Don't worry about that. We've got enough of those around here. But I said, yeah, no worries. I said, but, you know, listen, have a seat if you want to sit down. And he sort of burst into tears. And this was sort of like 9 o'clock in the morning. And he sort of burst into tears. And he said, you know, I want you to know, my sister died of a drug overdose last week. And the reason I've come down here to this room is to tell you, you know, that the work you're doing is really important. And, you know, had my sister had the opportunity to talk to someone like you, it might have been all different. And, you know, but it's like little moments like that. You think, okay, well, you know, we haven't got this kind of like flood of people, you know, but we have got these little sort of edge cases of, and we're like, yes, you know, despite everything, we are still doing the right thing, being visible, lifting up the, you know, the topic and all the rest of it. And yeah, but it was quite sweet, actually. And, you know, I think it goes to show, doesn't it, that, you know, if recovery and these sorts of things are not talked about, it's very, very easy to drop off the edge. And, you know, I've been to way too many funerals in the last 12 years of, you know, young people and old people and just, you know, just people that haven't made it, haven't got the message, haven't managed to find the right support. And it's freaking heartbreaking, you know, especially where there's young families involved or, you know, I think parents burying children is, you know, is one of the worst things to see. And but, you know, there is help. That is the message. There is help and there is a path, right?
I was just thinking while you were talking, I was thinking about the role of social media and messaging and things like that, and things that people can sort of drop into. And like, I mean, I don't know, like obviously like WhatsApp groups and stuff like that are brilliant, but I don't know if there's any way to do that and hide your identity or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, we set up a WhatsApp group and we've had that sort of challenge there too. And, you know, it's not really anonymous. We have spoken about, you know, we're in a sort of like a bit of a learning phase here at Recovery and Gaming. We've given ourselves a year to kind of find our feet and work out what works and what doesn't. But, you know, we have spoken as a group about some sort of anonymous messaging, you know, app, which is really easy to put together these days. And, you know, to really take the identity kind of out of it.
Something I was just thinking about, though, and I'm not trying to tell you how to suck eggs, because honestly, you're the expert in what you're doing, and I fucking don't. Well, no, I was thinking about, I don't know if you keep up with his posts on LinkedIn, but Leo Judkins has been doing some really interesting stuff with sort of coaches, sort of almost CEO coaching type stuff.
Yeah, the masterclass stuff.
That's it. It's that small group peer support.
Yeah.
Would be priceless in something like this, of just having 5, 6, 7 people you can reach out to. You know, so if you can't do anonymous, and let's face it, this industry is not massive in terms of the number of people in it.
No.
Once you take out the service aspect of it, it's actually quite small.
Yeah.
And we do all know each other, but do you know what I mean? If somebody contacted me at a show knowing that, you know, I'm a fat fucking binge eating drunk who quite likes drugs, and they reach out and they say, actually, I'm really fucking struggling here.
Yeah.
Of course I'm going to be there.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, definitely.
But that's because I've been able to speak publicly about being a fat fucking drunk and openly about it. And not everybody is in a position where they can do that, right?
Yeah. It's helpful, mate. Really helpful, isn't it? And I think you're right. I mean, I think this kind of like one-to-one or I mean, that is how recovery works, isn't it? But I mean, making individuals in recovery and gaming, you know, a little bit more visible with contact details and all the rest of it will of course be helpful. But I think there is still quite a big issue around, you know, the stigma of it in our industry, and I don't know whether it's the same everywhere, but I wonder if there's like a little bit of a kind of, you know, work hard, play hard type thing going on as well, which is like no one wants to really, you know, in addition to not wanting to talk about alcoholism, it's not kind of, you know, people don't want to be seen like they've sort of like failed at the play hard bit too. And I wonder if there's something kind of mixed up in that.
I always failed at the work hard part.
Yeah.
Work hard, play a bit, get an early night.
Hey?
Work hard, play a bit, and get an early night. That's how that should be structured.
Yeah.
We'll all function better, and the morning meetings won't be so terrible. Jeez, I just had a real weird memory. I remember being out on the lash one night in Macau. And I was in the did you ever go to the Venetian Macau?
I've never been, no. The Sands Venetian. Really?
So there's this Irish bar in there. Irish bar, you know the kind that I mean. And I was in the Irish bar with my publisher, and we met a couple of people that we know from they were at one of the slot distributors. And drinks flowed. And I tried to smuggle an alabaster lampshade out, and it was conical, so I tried to smuggle it out down the front of my trousers.
As you do.
I did manage to smuggle a snack bowl, a peanut bowl. I did smuggle that out. Well, but anyway, so next morning I wake up and I'm like, oh, fuck, what time is it? And, of course, it's like nearing midday.
Yeah, whose lampshade is this?
And I'd had one meeting that morning scheduled. And I phoned my publisher. I'm like, are you up and about? He's like, no, why would I be? It's so early. I'm like, look at the curtains. Why? Look at the bottom of the curtains. That's daylight.
Mm.
Oh, fuck. What time is it? Midday. Anyway, hurry down to G2E Asia, see the people that we had. And of course, the people we were meeting with were the people that we were drinking with last night. And right. they had been up and ready for the meeting.
That's it, man. Hardcore.
And this is back when I had hair.
Did you?
So I'm hair? Like, I woke up this morning. I had all this stuff in my hair. And this woman's like, yeah, you were wearing the bowl of nuts on your head.
Ah, nice. Done, yeah. John. Well done, you. There's nights like that, you know, you sort of wake up and have to piece it together.
Yeah. It's not great. Or those quiet nights when I'm just sitting and I'm reading my book and I'm getting drunk when I'm reading my book. And the next day I have to go back like six chapters.
I can't remember a single page.
Not a fucking clue. Listen, I do want to say, I mean, if there's anything that I can do personally, at any shows that I'm at, then obviously I'd be happy to help. And if anybody's listening to this and they're at ICE and they need to, you know, talk to somebody, you can give me a shout, or Recovery and Gaming will be there, and they probably do know a lot more than I do.
That's it. But listen, that's super kind as well. And I will take this opportunity. You'll probably edit this out, but I'll take this opportunity to say that we are raising some funds too at the moment. So,
dude, we don't edit anything out.
Oh, okay, good. All right. In that case, so we're actually raising £100,000 at the moment. And anyone that is interested, we've already had a bunch of interest from some of the big ones in the industry. So I think we'll definitely be able to hit our target. But we are raising 100,000, and that will help us bed in this whole project and keep it going. Look forward to talking to anyone who's got deep pockets.
Okay. Yeah, if anybody has any money to spare. But what, I mean, like in practical terms, in real terms, what would £100,000 go towards doing? I mean, because, I mean, people must ask these questions, especially when it's a fledgling organization.
Yeah, of course.
What, how does that help you develop?
Well, I think the first thing is like being in attendance at all of the events. You know, at the moment we're sort of bootstrapping this. So, and that can only go on for so long, right? And, so number one is making sure that Recovery and Gaming is at every event and is visible. Secondly, we're going into the sort of communication channels, right, that we spoke about. We've got some hokey pokey lovable website at the moment, which is, you know, fine. But really we need to expand that sort of communication piece. And then the third part of the funding is really going to help us to get inside organizations. So, to start running little awareness stuff with inside organizations, helping leaders understand what addiction is and what it isn't. And so that they're in a position then to help people themselves in their workforce. So, you know, the impact can be big and fast if we get this right. That's what we're planning.
Interesting. Talking to leaders, because information doesn't always propagate terribly well. But I would wonder if, and again, you know your stuff, and I am just pulling ideas out of my ass. But resources, shareable resources, but shareable resources that could be used by human resources teams,
100%.
That'd be priceless.
Yeah.
Because I'd like, you know what I mean? It's like sometimes you go to the doctor. Like the difference when you're treated by a doctor that's had gout compared to being treated by a doctor that has never had gout is night and day.
I can imagine.
And people understand what they've experienced.
That's it.
And, you know, I used to find this when I was working in consumer publishing. I used to like get a little bit of a budget of like 90 quid or whatever,
right. Go
down to the Quick Fit down the road, and I would just do one sheet, an information sheet, to go out to news agents all over the UK that just explained what the title was, where it should sit on the shelf, and all of this shit.
Nice.
And every title I did that with had humongous selling because the retailer got it. They didn't have to read it. Yeah. They just look at this and go, oh, it's that.
Yeah.
Right? It's just easy, digestible information that makes people's jobs a little bit easier and increases their understanding. And like, you know, oh, fuck, there's so many great education platforms. You know, there's like, Laura Da Silva Gomes and her thing. And, you know, there are these things that you can put courses on.
Yeah.
To teach people, okay, what questions should I ask? What questions shouldn't I ask? Because that's the other thing. People are afraid to inflict hurt on people that are hurting.
Oh, that's it. But I think also it's like, you know, I'm not saying this is true of all HR departments at all, but I think there is still this kind of line of discipline, which seems to be the first kind of step. You know, let's refer to the, you know, disciplinary procedure. What happens when someone turns up to work drunk? Well, you know, they get first is a verbal warning, and because there's nothing else there to sort of say, oh, instead of that, do this, or have this conversation, like you're saying, ask these questions. You know, I think it becomes a sort of default disciplinary. You know, that was not the way that I was dealt with, thankfully. But I think you're absolutely right.
When in doubt, hide behind the rule book, right?
Oh, that's it. Yeah, that's it. So yeah, you're absolutely bang on about the materials, though. I love that.
Awesome. I mean, it's like nearly 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and that is probably the first thing I've got right today.
Brilliant, John. It's been a pleasure to be here, and I thank you for your time and for helping us raise a bit of awareness here.
I've got loads more questions.
Okay.
No, I'm just fucking with you.
I knew you were running dry.
Hugh, where can people find you? Where's your shiny little website as it stands?
So recoveringgaming.com. We are there, and it's a little one-page website at the moment. But you can find our contact details there and email addresses and I think mobile phone numbers there and WhatsApp group there and links to AA and NA. But that's a good port call. And if anyone wants to get in contact with me directly, my number's there.
Okay. And anybody with deep pockets who wants to do some good for their anonymous peers should definitely get in touch because... I have zero doubts that you're going to do some wonderful work, but in order to do wonderful work, money gives people the freedom to do it. And I don't mean that as in, yeah, you need a big fucking salary. I just mean it's far easier to do things effectively when you're not having to scrabble around for peanuts.
You know that, definitely, 100%.
So, anybody listening that can help with that, then get in touch. Well, get in touch with us or get in touch with Hugh directly, as he says, on the website recoveryandgaming.com. Thank you for joining us, Hugh. It's been a pleasure. And anything that we at the podcast can do to support you, then just share. I mean, I know that you went to all the other podcasts first, but we wanted you first. Well, it's a subject close to my heart, my flabby, palpitating heart.
You wanted us warmed up on the other podcast before you hit your hair.
I wanted them to do the foreplay so you could just come here for the orgasm.
That's funny.
I consider the other podcasts our fluffers.
Fluffers. I say nothing.
Thank you, Hugh. If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You can find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just at Gambling Files. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And... you can find all of our previous episodes at www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share, tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.